Hello and welcome to the Unsightly American Soccer Podcast, post-World Cup, pre-apocalyptic, but just barely, edition. I'm your host, Hal Phillips, and today, with the EPL and EuroLeague seasons looming, we check in with our sage pundits, Tom Wadlington and Stephen Myers, to recap the World Cup, with the clear eye only time enables. But we transition to the North American summer silly season just ended, with its myriad exhibitions, to talk some U.S. soccer. We caught up with Tom Wadlington literally in his car on his way to Fenway Park for the Celtic Sporting Lisbon match before picking up with Esteban live from his late 19th century technology-equipped bachelor pad in the East Bay. One note on Tom's report in our conversation, Jozy Altidore was rumored to be headed several different places during our conversation, but he's staying at Villarreal in Spain for the foreseeable future at least. And Jermaine Jones ultimately did not debut for the U.S. versus Brazil friendly on August 10. This means any redemption of the American defensive midfield situation remains on indefinite hold. Let's get to it. So, let me just get this right. Only $75 to watch Sporting against Celtic in a game that doesn't matter at Fenway Park.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, if you can justify that, you go right ahead.
You know what? I would have gladly paid double that, and I'll tell you why. Because watching Glasgow Celtic, even in an exhibition friendly in the preseason, is one of life's great experiences.
Because of the fans, the traveling fans.
Because of the fans, and the fact these people have a fucking global fandom that is absolutely stellar. Okay? And the Irish are some of the best fans in the world in terms of not battering the fuck out of the opponent's fans and causing mayhem.
I think they're sure to get a lot of Celtic fans there, and whether or not the Celtic fans from Brighton or Dorchester really pull off the sort of, cultured and mellow fandom that you are looking for, that remains to be seen.
Yeah, well, I went in 06. That's the whole reason that I'm going, is I went to see them play the lowly Revs of New England at Gillette Stadium, and they had 15,000 Celtic fans and about 5,000 Revs fans. And I sat with Celtic and sang the songs and enjoyed the evening. Okay.
So are you driving down there right now?
Yes.
Well, listen, I've got you recorded. Let's talk about the World Cup briefly, and then you can give us an update on the Bob Bradley Fulham situation.
Yes, and it's not too late for you to get your shit together and come down here and watch a proper Glasgow Celtic football match.
I'll try to consider it, but there is a lot going on, and I do have a life, Tom.
Well, that's everyone's excuse, isn't it?
Wait, it's been 2 weeks. You know, your thoughts on the final?
Well, I was very disappointed that neither team scored early in the game. I would have even settled for a goal at the beginning of the second half, but it didn't happen. It went to extra time. I had to have a shot of whiskey just to allay my disappointment and fears that the game was going into penalty kicks, which would have been a terrible way to end it, right?
I agree.
But David Villa came through for Spain, and I guess the best team won. And there could have been several people sent off due to egregious challenges that should have been red cards.
I guess I can only think of one, and that was the cleat to the sternum that De Jong gave to Xavi Alonso. When that first happened, I saw the Spaniards crowding around Howard Webb, the referee, gesturing with their hands that there should be a card, a red card, and I guess I was not paying close enough attention because I thought it was a bit much, and then I saw the replay and I was like, oh my, that is a red card.
Yeah, it was a horrible challenge that should have resulted in an immediate dismissal, red card. But let's talk very briefly about how the dynamics of a final can be shaped by a goal by the better team early in the game, or let's say early in the second half. If Spain had scored that goal, what would the Netherlands have had to do to play the game effectively as opposed to what they actually did?
Well, I guess they would have had to throw more people forward and expose themselves more, and they probably would have given up another goal.
Perfect.
Right, and I think that if you're really a neutral, or you were a neutral, what you're rooting for is a Dutch goal. Because if that had happened, Spain would have had to throw more guys forward, and they wouldn't have been quite so patient holding the ball in midfield, and they would have it would have been more of a back and forth affair in the second half. But I mean, honestly, there's been so much said and written about how negative the Dutch were in this game. I thought the second half was pretty darn fun. It was back and forth, and the Dutch, for all their clutching, grabbing, and kicking, they could have won that game. Robin should have, could have scored on one of the two breakaways he had, and they could have stolen that game very easily. So while they did not play attractive soccer, no one does when they are compared with the Spanish and they have to play against the Spanish, they could have easily won that game.
Right. I totally agree with you. I think one of the games that comes to mind that there were some parallels with was Fulham playing Shakhtar Donetsk at Craven Cottage. And if I remember correctly, Fulham went up very early on kind of a fluky goal by Zoltan Gera, and then proceeded not to touch the ball for the next 30 minutes because the Brazilian wizardry of the Shakhtar Donetsk players was just incredible, to the point where Fulham fans that have been going for 40 years said that was the best football I've ever seen at Craven Cottage.
This was the first leg of what, the quarterfinal of the Europa Cup this year?
Yes, I believe that's correct. It was the first leg, and they had to go and get a result. They got a tie, 1-1 in Russia or whatever Shakhtar Donetsk is.
It's the Ukraine.
Later in the Ukraine. Sorry about that. Didn't mean to offend any Russians, but or Ukrainians. But anyway, the passing and skill level and speed at which they played was comparable to Spain. I would say you might argue in patches it was better than Spain. It was that good. And yet Fulham somehow prevailed because they had a stellar defense and they were highly organized, and their midfielders came back and really sat up at the top of the box, defended. And it, you know, some people say that's negative, you're killing the game off, et cetera, but that is the reality when you play a team that's clearly superior.
Yeah,
like a Spain.
Exactly. I mean, and this is what Fulham did, I think, the last three rounds that they played in the Europa Cup, and this is what the Dutch were obliged to do in the World Cup final, is that they were playing a team that was better than they were. They knew it, and they had to do something to achieve a result. And I think that Fulham goes after that result in a cleaner fashion. They aren't as determined to kick you as it appeared the Dutch were determined to kick the Spaniards. But, you know,
right,
you have to do something. The idea that you just say, hey, well, you know, if we can't win playing, you know, beautiful soccer, we're just going to take our lumps and lose 4-0. No one does that.
No, they don't. But a team like Fulham that was so highly organized under Roy Hodgson could literally sit back and defend at the top of the box and allow the superior opponent to come down and pass the ball around at will and then deny them a good shot on goal, which was truly amazing. It's a pinnacle of defensive football.
Well, and I think this is one of the reasons that we wanted to see a Brazil and Spanish final, because I think that if the Spanish are playing well, as we saw, very, very few teams can hang with them playing proper football. We saw that the Germans try and they got thumped. Even though they lost only 1-0, they really hardly threatened the Spanish goal, because you can't attack when you don't have the ball. And we saw a very good Dutch team that, you know, had their chances to score, but was obliged to play a pretty sort of rugged brand of football to make that happen. I think that if the Brazilians had had a chance to play the Spanish, we would have had a Clásico.
I absolutely agree, and that's why I was disappointed. As much as I like the Netherlands and the fact that it was their first, not their first final, but it would have been their first World Cup victory, and that would have been kind of cool for not only the Dutch, but everyone, in a way. I thought we were cheated out of that dream final between Brazil and Spain, as you said.
But let's go back and talk about, because this is the Unsightly American soccer podcast. Let's talk about Fulham, because Roy Hodgson has left for Liverpool. And there is talk that U.S. men's national team coach Bob Bradley is being considered for the top spot at Craven Cottage. I know that it's not a shoe-in by any means, but maybe you could catch up our listeners on just what's happening there, Tom.
Right. So I think Bob Bradley, as of yesterday, was 7-1 odds for getting the Fulham job on Betfair, or one of the big betting sites in the UK. But realistically, is he going to get a shot at this job? No, he won't. He would be a third or fourth choice, which would be a bit disastrous, even if it did happen. If the stars aligned such that Fulham had to go to their third or fourth choice after what is arguably their finest season in 100-year-plus history, it would be disastrous. People would be up in arms, angry. The supporters would say, how come we didn't attract a big-name manager that would take the club further based on our results in getting to the Europa Cup final last year? Martin Jol is the number one choice, and they're in Amsterdam right now. The Fulham CEO is trying to negotiate with Ajax of Amsterdam in terms of releasing Martin Jol from his contract, and I think Ajax is playing hardball trying to drive up the price that Fulham will have to pay to get Martin Jol, who previously brought Tottenham Hotspurs to fifth place twice in the Premier League.
Well, I remember I'm recalling the so-called interest that was shown in England for Bruce Arena after the U.S. did so well at the 2002 World Cup in South Korea and Japan, and I think it was sort of perfunctory. I think it's going to take something really special for an American coach to get a chance to lead a premiership side. I mean, honestly, there hasn't even been an American coach leading a championship side or a League One side, right? I mean, it's unprecedented.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. And I think if the stars did align and Bob Bradley or any other American coach came over to the Premier League or even the First Division in England, you would see xenophobia rear its ugly head, and you would have supporters screaming anti-American epithets, even though they're our special allies. I think it's strange that the American owners, for the most part, are not well liked over there. The Gillette and Gillette and Hicks at Liverpool and Glazer at Man United, they poisoned the well in terms of American owners working successfully and being accepted over in England, although there are a couple of exceptions. One of them is John Berylson, who actually lives in our hometown of Wellesley, Massachusetts, and he is the owner of newly promoted Millwall, who will be in the Championship, which is the tier just below the Premier League. There's also what's Randy's last name? Well, Randy Lerner.
Randy Lerner at Villa.
At Aston Villa is fairly well regarded and is looked upon as the right kind of owner that maximizes the potential of a club without spending a lot of money.
Yeah, I think that a poisoning the well is a little strong. I mean, obviously the Hicks and Gillette situation at Liverpool is horrendous, and the Glazer situation is beyond that. But is that really the same thing as a manager? I don't think so, and I think that the way that Landon Donovan as a player was accepted over the winter transfer period this past year was amazing. I mean, this guy is not a dominant player. He's a nice little player, but, geez, they took him into their bosom. I was amazed by that.
Yeah, so you look at players, field players, as they call them, like like Clint Dempsey and Landon Donovan who can contribute effectively for a top 10 Premier League team, they will be accepted. And, you know, there are many times when Clint Dempsey's song is sung by the fans at Fulham. But in terms of a manager, what I'm hearing from Fulham fans is, you know what, Bradley, it's the same scenario that we had with Laurie Sanchez. He overachieved with Northern Ireland that really had very little in the way of international talent, but he had no former Premier League management experience. He came to Fulham, he played a horrible brand of long ball, and the team was headed toward relegation. And so why would we want to repeat that with Bob Bradley, especially when Americans know nothing about football?
I think that's a fair comment. I don't know about the last part, but I know that's just the Fulham folks being a little bit churlish. But, yeah, I think the Sanchez parallel is fair and apt. So, I don't think it's going to happen. I think something extraordinary would have to happen for someone like Bradley to get a job even in the Championship. So I hope they get Martin Jol. And speaking of Ajax, do we hear any more about Jozy Altidore maybe going there?
No, I think everything is hanging in the balance. I hear that there are meetings going on all day today in Amsterdam where they're trying to convince Martin Jol that the Ajax financial situation is not as dire as it was thought to be. They were thought to be 20 million in debt, and they were going to have to sell off their goalkeeper, who was the starter for the Dutch team, Stekelenburg, and Suarez, who was the incredible striker for Uruguay in the World Cup, as well as Vanderbilt, who is the Dutch right back. And basically, if they can convince Martin Jol that they have the financial wherewithal to keep those players and to buy some quality players, he will stay. If Martin Jol leaves and they sell those players, they will need to buy someone like Jozy Altidore.
Well, that's interesting. I saw also that Charlie Davies came on for Sochaux in a friendly.
Yes, that's right.
Came on in the 97th minute or something like that. So, I mean, that's a good sign that he is somewhat fit.
I was going to say that's a good sign that he was unfit and that it was a good decision not to bring him to the World Cup.
Well,
with all due respect to the fellow for all of his hard work.
Well, I think that's obvious. I mean, and in fact, if you really wanted to be pointed about it, Onyewu was not fit and shouldn't have been brought. But they weren't ever pushed on that fact. I don't think they would have brought someone who would have gotten any time ahead of the people who didn't even play.
Right. So Onyewu was brought and started the first game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, there's a parallel there with Fabio Capello bringing Ledley King, who had a terrible history with his knee injuries. And, you know, Onyewu, yes, he didn't have a history like Ledley King, but he wasn't fit, and he took up a roster spot, and it probably wasn't a good idea.
Yeah, in other news, our friend Jermaine Jones, who was going to be our midfield savior, is finally apparently fit and is ready to play for Schalke when the Bundesliga season starts, I guess, in August.
Right. That's going to be interesting to see, since he really hasn't played for, what, a year now?
Has not played since May 2009.
Okay, so over a year. He'll be coming up on, well, a year and 3 months or so. That's a long time to not have a competitive football match when you're a professional. if he comes back, I have high doubts that this will happen, but if he comes back anywhere near the form that he had previously when he had been made captain of Schalke or Frankfurt, Eintracht Frankfurt, he could be a huge addition to the United States national team.
He is 28 years old, though, so he'll be 32 by the time the next World Cup comes around. So let's all keep our hats on, as they say.
Yes. I mean, let's just assume that if he came back to 90% of what he was, and he can contribute to the World Cup qualifying cycle here in the CONCACAF region, that would be big.
So, hey, let's close by talking about another exhibition. Are you going down to the Meadowlands to see U.S.-Brazil on August 10th?
Absolutely.
Of course you are. Of course you are.
I don't have a life, as you pointed out. Would I miss this after seeing Argentina and the USA in a pointless friendly at Giant Stadium 2 years ago, a sellout crowd of 78,000 with a smattering of U.S. fans?
Well, we've been to some Brazil games at Foxborough exhibitions, and it's the best tailgate in world football, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, no one does a party like the Brazilians, right? They live to party. So you've got the music, the dancing, the drinking, the procreating, God knows what goes on, but it's the best collection of football fans I've been around anywhere.
And I think, to be fair, when the game is played in the United States and the U.S. brings the American fans, smattering of them, though they may be, we bring the tailgating ethic to the party.
Yes, so we provide the same shot and uniquely American culture of tailgating, and the foreigners, the Brazilians, Argentinians, whatever country they're from, bring the football passion and the party. So it's a nice collaboration.
Well, I won't be attending that event, so we'll be looking forward to your report from the Meadowlands, Tom.
Perfect. I will be happy to phone in and share some samba music with you.
And enjoy Sporting versus Celtic tonight.
Thank you very much, Al.
Off you go.
Cheers. Bye.
Hola.
Hey, Hal, is that you?
It is, indeed. This is a good time?
Yeah, we could wrap now. I was expecting a call from an elder, Hal, who is someone very dear to me, and quite legitimately an elder. He's a Lakota medicine man, and someone very close. Hal, can I call him? We could wrap. Could you call me in 10 minutes, and I'll square with him?
Are you going to have to tell the audience and me exactly what's going to go down with this Lakota elder, though, because he can't tease us like that.
No, I'm sorry, brother. You did it again. You didn't know. You didn't let me know we were already off and running and on the go. I'm still...
You didn't give anything away.
I'm still just new to this podcast thing. I mean, I can't tell. I couldn't say enough how I'm... You know, I'm gingerly making my steps out of the 19th century. God damn, Pluto. Always with tricks up your sleeve. Like back in the day when I think it's, you're a senior. Let's see, I'm a junior. Is that right? Yeah, on the soccer team. And we have this long, long team conversation, you know, over in the presence and in the company of our Captain Queeg about possibly as a team ceasing drinking for the season to create a solidarity and a seriousness and a steadfastness, right? The previous year we'd been little three champs and you participate, but the whole time in the conversation, you know, you ain't gonna fucking stop drinking.
If I recall correctly, I did play along as a philosophical sort of construct, the whole idea.
You can, you and me both, man, you can sling some shit, Bluto.
Hey, that's my game. Hey, you call me when you're ready, and then I'll call you back. Okay, let me just have a conversation here with Tom in the engineering booth. Tom, can we cue the Lakota tribal music, please? Right now? What? We don't have any Lakota tribal music? All right, then, let's just go to the rest of the interview.
Hey, no sweat, man. I know that you're in a command center there that is wildly past beyond my ken.
Well, I think that I'd like to refer to it more organically as a nerve center. It's a human place. It's biological in nature. All the decisions here are made, you know, by a human.
Yeah, good on you. I'm almost envious, but actually not quite. You know, envy must be purged. That's an important lesson that everyone in our massive audience ought to, you know, is well served by that reminder.
It is massive, and I was just actually, someone sent me a, someone in my audience sent me a Well, I guess they communicated it via Facebook or something like that about the Arlington, Massachusetts schools reinstituting the Pledge of Allegiance. I don't know why that rubs me so wrong, but there's no reason in the world why we should have ever had one. Somehow, as a country, we lasted 100 years without one. They came up with one stupid one in 1875. They used that for a while, and then in the 50s, they inserted Under God in there to fight communism. Why are we even doing this?
You know, I teach public school in San Francisco, sort of an esoteric, not sort of an esoteric and even quixotic ministry. I go in every day. This will be my 10th year at the end of August. Keeps me broke and feeling decent. And not every school does it, but some do. You know, I stand, I try to be as inconspicuous as possible. It is very much a kind of conscription. Oy.
I agree with you, and I wonder whether or not I'm just being reactionary, and whether or not this is really something that's essentially harmless. But it's not.
It's not that. It's not harmless.
Oh, good. Wow, that was close. I thought for a minute there I was getting soft.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me, but it does surprise me that even at a Little League baseball game, even at any soccer game that my son played of any sort of import, they actually go to the trouble to have someone come in and sing the national anthem or pipe it in somehow. And, you know, in a country, you know, like the former Czechoslovakia or like today in a place like, you know, for better or for worse, Egypt, this is what they do. Why do we do it?
I don't know.
It's not right.
I'm a little bit surprised by your question. You're someone who's sort of normally not lacking for answers, Bluto, although you put questions really well and in this format, too.
I'm playing journalist.
Why do we do it? Well, hey, bro, you might have noticed, let's going back to sports, which is, and getting back to our subject, the World Cup, you know, long since replaced, I maintain strongly, religion as the opiate of the masses. I mean, do you remember after September 11th, 2001, as we saw on Fox TV in the playoffs and in the World Series, and the Yankees were in the World Series, that they instituted God Bless America at the seventh inning stretch before taking me out to the ballgame.
Exactly. These things emerge in times of anxiety.
And it has not been relinquished.
Well, right? It will eventually, I'm sure. And I guess that isn't that a saving grace that at some
point. No, I'm not sure.
Dropped.
I don't agree with you there.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Well, it did fall out of favor, the Pledge of Allegiance, for example, and even after they inserted Under God to fight communism in the 50s. It fell out of favor, and then it came back, and then it fell out again, and it comes back in certain places. And isn't it right and proper that this comes and goes?
Here on the home front, you know, we got set up for, and we're still constantly being set up, and the populace is being conscripted into attitudes and an acceptance of perpetual war. I mean, that was just weeks after September 11th that Cheney, we won't go into his history too much, you know, laid that down. On it goes. So, you know, the God Bless America is still around, and the Pledge of Allegiance in certain places, has come back into its place.
It's funny, though, the name of it, the Pledge of Allegiance, actually, when you really listen to yourself saying it, it sounds Orwellian. It sounds like something, you know, an apparatchik came up with in the Ukraine in, you know, 1957.
Well, not harmless. I mean, a couple of minutes ago, you were wondering if it were harmless, right? Now, I think you got to it.
That's just a label. You know, what we call it is different from what it actually is and does. And the name, because it is antique, it's, you know, I think that phrase was dreamed up in the 1880s when the Pledge of Allegiance was formulated by a guy who I think went on to form or be involved with the Boy Scouts of America. He was that type of guy. Mm-hmm. And so I think it reflects more that the antique nature of the mm-hmm. verbiage and not the real intention of it. But it's still, I'm just saying, it strikes me as something that should be amended or should have evolved in some way, because it, when you really listen to it, it sounds peculiar for a free society.
Yep. I'm accustomed to hearing it at Sanchez Elementary School, which is a public school in the city, and, you know, out here west of the Mississippi, that's the city of San Francisco. And, you know, where there's a, you know, a couple hundred young Latinos, almost entirely Latinos, the parents immigrants or illegal immigrants. Or
how many would be illegal if you had to guess at a percentage?
Let me back off that stronger term is, you know, without papers or without documentation, you're an illegal immigrant. If it comes to word, turn, look up, put your hand over your heart.
To bring it back, you know, again to the issue is like, do you feel uncomfortable when they trot out the two teams for an international football match and bring the flags and sing the national anthems and impose on the crowd and the players to feign allegiance to something? In that way, I think it's a beautiful ceremony, ritual. Do you?
Yeah, it is ritual. And, you know, the pomp and circumstance to accompany the bread and the circus.
Panem et circenses.
Thank you. Good stuff there, Senator.
For you Latin lovers out there.
Yes, indeed, and we are. Yes, we certainly are.
No, I think it's...
Many puns going on there. yeah, it's the World Cup, of course, right? So,
but,
so they're going to do all that. I went to 4 Olympics, you know, Hal.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a lot of anthems. And, you know, there's a lot of this, a lot of ceremony, a lot of ritual. It's elevating. You know, we're tribes.
But somehow it's not cool to do that ritual every day at school. And I'm not trying to trouble. I mean, I agree with you. And yet we draw the line some places and revel in it in other places.
Well, I think one thing about the Pledge of Allegiance that is said in this country that we have echoing in our heads from 35, 36, almost 40 years ago, and that I occasionally see it one school or another, is that it's just plainly untrue. And to the republic for which it stands, one nation. I mean, this is such an extraordinarily diverse culture. Now, the corporate commercial culture, the stuff we find on TV, that's, no matter how many channels there are, that there is a homogenizing process that's hard at work there and unceasing.
Football is a homogenizing thing.
Oh, man.
Isn't it?
Football. Jesus. Oh, God, I immediately flashed to American football.
Oh, come on now. We're in the vernacular now. Soccer is a homogenizing thing.
Yeah, forgive me.
You were in your martial mode, but I'm not trying to make trouble. I am trying to like just peel it back a little bit because I think football, soccer is a homogenizing enterprise, purposely and beautifully, ritually, and I like that. And yet I agree that I don't want to be standing there at my son's little league game, you know, all the time, having to sort of, you know, having to pose, and why am I posing? Is this necessary? Is there some worry that if we don't do this, we'll lose control of ourselves? That
now you're onto something real there. I think right, that pressure.
Yeah.
You know, that is palpable within. You know, who's watching me? Who's reading the brow of my forehead? Who knows that this pisses me off? And what might some consequences or cost be of, you know, if I were to let this show? Yeah, on we go, Pluto.
Wow, that was sort of heavy. We'll be back with more actual football talk with Esteban in parts 2 and I think parts 3. This is a long conversation. So, yeah, actual soccer talk about the World Cup in part 2 and 3. Please join us.